and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the critical role of the Latino vote in the upcoming election and speak with Antonio Gonzalez, president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. We'll discuss the latest census survey that finds Latino registration grew during 2010 to 2014, but the rate of U.S. Latino votes cast was its lowest ever, while the national Latino vote was stagnant due to its collapse in California. And now that the GOP presidential candidates are talking about closing doors and bashing Muslims, who Ben Carson likened to rabid dogs, instead of building walls against Latinos, we'll look into how much the Latino vote in 2016 will be mobilized in response to the racist insults against Latinos from Donald Trump and others. Then we'll speak with the conservation biologist Paul Ehrlich about his new book, The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals, that features beautiful pictures of the endangered creatures that we all celebrate as gifts of nature, whose extinction mankind is causing. We'll discuss the role of population growth in destroying biodiversity while human-caused climate change threatens food supplies for a global population that will double in a few decades. We will also discuss how you can become a mobster by joining MAHB, M-A-H-B, the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, which connects activists, scientists, humanists, and civil society to foster global change. And joining us now is Antonio Gonzalez, the president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. During Gonzalez's tenure, they have tripled Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 14 million registrants in 2012. He's a regular commentator on the Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Session. Welcome to Background Briefing, Antonio Gonzalez.
Thanks for having me, Ian. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Antonio, and I wish you a happy Thanksgiving tomorrow. And I wanted to just touch on this report that came out last week from the Pew Research Center that found that more Mexican immigrants were returning to Mexico from the U.S. than were coming in. About 900,000 Mexican immigrants returned to Mexico from the U.S. between 2009 and 2014. Many taking about 100,000 U.S.-born children under the age of five with them. And during that same time frame, an estimated 870,000 Mexican immigrants left Mexico to come to the U.S. So how do you explain all this immigrant bashing? Or do you think the Latinos are getting a kind of break now that the Republicans are now beating up on Syrians more than they are on Mexicans?
Well, it is a twisted logic that Mexicans and Latinos are getting a break, but it may well be true. I often used to tell my friends in the Bolivarian Revolution that the reason they were able to develop their left-wing development and reform processes since 1998 is because the United States doesn't have enough military to invade two different hemispheres at the same time. The post World War II era, that is, because the U.S. military was tied down in the Middle East, Latin America, South America in particular, was an alternative development model was allowed to take root and flourish, as we've seen 15 years later, and take tens of millions of people out of poverty and so on. Look, it's not news that in migration from Mexico is down. There's a couple of factors at play here. Migration from Mexico is driven by the capital and labor markets. And when the economy is robust, more Mexicans tend to come. When the economy is down, Mexicans tend to go back. And there is a circulatory pattern, historically, to Mexican migration. That's been made much more difficult by American punitive laws over the last 20 years, but it's still there. One, and two, 3 million Latinos have been, 2 million Latinos have been, most of Latinos have been deported by President Obama, and probably a million before that by President Bush, and that has its impact. Most of those are Mexicans. And then third, Mexico's demographics are changing. That is, Mexico does not produce as many surplus labor force entrants as they used to, because Mexico slowly but surely is getting, comparatively speaking, more affluent. And the more affluent any country gets, its birth rate tends to go down. Mexico's birth rate has gone down dramatically since World War II. It's an award winner in family planning, and also it has, the Mexican middle class has grown, and fewer children are produced per family. Therefore, there's not as many Mexicans that are additional to what the jobs the Mexican economy produces. Therefore, less persons apt to migrate, and the number one migration destination for Mexico historically is the United States. So there's several factors, and the bottom line is, I don't think it's not going to change that much. I think the era of a mass Mexican out-migration to the United States is over. And, you know, Washington is always the last one to know about any given fact in its economy or in its society. And the Mexican bashing that has helped Donald Trump so much is largely fictitious, based on fictitious assumptions.
And again, I'm speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. During Gonzalez's tenure, they have tripled Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 14 million registrants in 2012. He's a regular commentator on Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Session. Now, the institute that you head up, the William Velasquez Institute, Antonio Gonzalez, you recently put out a report that was based on U.S. Census Bureau current population survey voting and registration series in 2014, and you called the report The Latino Vote in 2014, The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. The good being that U.S. Latino registration grew during 2010 to 2014, and the bad is that U.S. Latino votes cast were stagnant. The rate of U.S. Latino votes cast was its lowest ever. And then the ugly is the national Latino voter turnout was stagnant due to collapse in California. So walk us through those three, starting with the good.
Well, from 2010 to 2014, you generally measure these things by governor election to governor election, president election to president election. So when you look at the Latino vote in 2014, you find that almost 13 million Latinos are registered to vote, and that compares favorably. There were about 11 million registered to vote in 2010, so about a 2 million growth, which is numerically the largest governor-to-governor election year growth the Latino vote has ever seen since the Census Bureau began counting Latino voters in 1972. That's the good. Note that the percentage growth is shrinking, but I'm not really alarmed about that. The percentage growth is, growth is shrinking. About 18% was the growth, I believe, because it's a bigger, you know, math. It's a bigger denominator, right? We have a bigger base to grow from, and therefore we grow almost 2 million, and it's only 18%. You know, 10 years ago we grew 2 million, it would be 50%. So there's still health in that growth rate from governor to governor race. I'm going to go to the bad in a second, but there's an ugly to this, the good, the bad, and the ugly. There's an ugly to this, which is the recent growth. In fact, we're 13 million now. We were 11 million, but we were 14 million in 2012. So the growth rate was really from 2010 to 2012, 3 million. And then we shrank a million through 2014. And that's the ugly, one of the ugly parts of the report. There's this new cycle in the Latino vote, which is really a boom-bust cycle. You boom in the presidential year, and then you bust afterwards. You grow dramatically, and then you shrink. But you don't shrink to worse than what you were in the previous cycle, but you nevertheless shrink from your peak. And that's a new trend in the Latino electorate. Historically, the Latino electorate grew for 20 years in a row, no matter what cycle. But really, since the economic collapse, residential mobility is so high, and that does throw you out of the electorate. Unemployment, that enhances residential mobility. That's an even bigger factor in the Latino community, as it is in all disadvantaged communities. And the new partisan nature of the politics has also changed, meaning the Democrats are much more organized, Republicans are much more organized, and they care much more only about presidential cycles. So there's far less investment in the Latino vote in gubernatorial cycles than there is in presidential cycles. And when you combine that with the other new fact of Latino politics, which is basically the two biggest states, Texas and California, which have about 40% of all Latino voters, are now in states with essentially no competition. And no competition drives down registration and voting. Texas is going to be Republican winner for at every top of the ticket race for the foreseeable future. And California now appears to be basically the same, except Democratic. And with one-party domination of any state, competition and investment are down, and therefore participation is down. So that's the ugly. Now, the bad part is that voting is down. The rate of voting is down. Even though the number of registration is up, the rate of voting is down in 2014. That's very concerning. But when you look underneath that, it was down to 53%, which is the lowest it's ever been, again, since the Census Bureau started counting, for an off-year election. In presidential elections, Latinos vote very high, and that pattern hasn't changed. They're, on average, 80% turnout of registered. But in gubernatorial races, the rate has been about 60% for the last four or five cycles. That is now down to nearly 50%. And what happened there is, you know, in essence, what happened, the Latinos followed the national pattern, which was down. The national pattern was down, turnout was down. But that's new, Ian, as well, because Latinos typically have their own pattern. For example, in 2010, national voting was down in that gubernatorial cycle, but Latino voting was up. We have our own logic. But not in 2014. We parroted the national pattern with slight declines in voting in across nationally, in all states, with the exception of California, where California was down and Texas was down substantially, particularly California, which is usually a star of Latino voting, usually closer to 70% than 60%, the national average being 60, but California is usually 70. This time California was about 50% turnout. And so California is so big, it takes down national Latino performance. Again, California has over 3 million Latino voters. That's a big, big, big number. And so that's you have a very mixed picture. In particular, because California and Texas are sort of out of play for president, and they're now out of play for governor between the two parties, that has had a detrimental effect to Latino participation. Now, what does this all mean going forward? Well, it means for the presidential cycle that we can expect Latino voting to grow from 13 million to about 15 million of registration. Voter registration grows from 13 to 15. You may think, well, 2 million, that's pretty good. Well, in Latino politics, that's very average. The hope was that we would grow to 16 million. So this boom-bust cycle is actually hurting our growth in presidential cycles. Does that matter? Yeah, it does matter, because Latinos comprise about 20% of the voters in battleground states. So if that pattern is true in battleground states, that's a problem. Yeah, so that's one impact, and there's some more, but go ahead.
Well, Antonio, let's just take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with Antonio Gonzalez. Nos manejan mal. Dame, 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 dame todo el power para que te demos en la madre. Give me, give me, give me, give me todo el poder so I can come around to joder. Dame, 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 dame todo el power para que te Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Antonio Gonzalez, who's the president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. And during Gonzalez's tenure, the SVREP have nearly tripled Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 14 million registrants in 2012. He's a regular commentator on the Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Session. So you've walked us through the good, the bad, and the ugly of this new report from the William C. Velasquez Institute that you head up, Antonio, based upon U.S. Census Registration Bureau current population survey voting and registration series in 2014, the good, the bad, and the ugly in terms of the Latino vote. So what do you think it's going to take then? I mean, in terms of this 2016 year coming up, I mean, given the inflammatory nature, the aggressively inflammatory nature of the Trump candidacy, the casual and cruel and despicable scapegoating of Latinos in this country, is just outrageous. And my assumption would be that there's going to be a backlash.
Well, there's three kinds of things that I think we should talk about, Ian. And this is in we released two studies. We were talking about the first one, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And then we released a second study on November the 12th called The Latino Vote in 2016, Early Presidential Primaries and Caucuses in Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, Florida, and California. And what we find in this contradictory Latino vote performance, growing and shrinking, turnout high in presidential cycles but low in gubernatorial cycles, problems. There have been problems in Texas, but now the sick men of Latino politics are now Texas and California. What it means, on the one hand, is we'll get 15 million registered voters in 2016, not 16 million, but we also find that within Latino politics, which are essentially 20 states, have at least 100,000 Latino voters, there are some superstar states. And there's some characteristics that they share which go to your question. Those superstar states are Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, and Florida. And Nevada, Colorado, and Florida are very interesting because they've had hyper growth in registration and voting during the same contradictory period that the national Latino vote in California, Texas have been all over the map. And in Colorado, Nevada, and Florida, the hyper growth is due to heavy partisan investment. They've been battleground states. They've been fought for hand-to-hand, figuratively speaking, for in 2014 for gubernatorial and Senate races in 2012 and 2008 and 2004 in Florida's and 2000 in Florida's case for presidential. And investment matters. Competition matters. So those states, you know, while national Latino registration is only about 50%, in those states it's over 60%. While the growth was about 18% from 2010 to 2014 nationally in the Latino vote, in these states you're looking at 30, 40, 50, 60% Latino vote growth. Investment matters, and that investment, I bet you, that investment is going to continue in 2016 from both parties because they're battleground states. But to your point, the more interesting question to me is the growth in Arizona, which is equally spectacular compared to Colorado, Nevada, and Florida, with no investment. And in fact, it's because of Sheriff Joe Arpaio and the anti-immigrant movement, which has been about for 10 years in Arizona, which has stoked just massive growing in Arizona from about 200,000 registered voters in 2000 to over 700,000 registered voters now, from just 100,000, 150,000 votes being cast to over 500,000, over 400,000 votes being cast in 2010 and 2012. It's just a spectacular growth. If Arizona continues its growing, it'll become the fifth U.S. state with the least Latino voters by 2018. And it hasn't been competitive. It's been a reliably Republican state, and it's been and very little national money has come into Arizona. Very little, any kind of money has come into Arizona. But the population is passionately mobilized and organized by Arizona leadership, Latino leadership, to fight Sheriff Joe Arpaio, to fight SB 1070, which was the Prop 187 of Arizona, excluding immigrants. There have been successful recall campaigns against racist state senators in 2011 that sponsored SB 1070. All kinds of things are going on. I would say Arizona has been for the last 8 years the hotbed of Latino politics in America. It's very much like California in the 1990s, where in gubernatorial cycles, again, as I mentioned before, gubernatorial cycles, all voting is down, including Latino voting. But in Arizona, they're voting at presidential levels of turnout, 70% plus. Well, just like in California from 1994 through 1998, Latinos in California voted at presidential rates of around 80%. We can now say that's the Trump factor. We've seen it in California in the 90s. We've seen it in Arizona over the last 8 to 10 years. And if Trump is the Republican nominee, we're going to see it across America.
Well, the assumption is, of course, that the reason there's a greater turnout in presidential years is that the top of the ticket is what attracts people.
Yes, so it's a metaphor for American citizenship.
Sure. But let's look at the top of the ticket then. I mean, as far as the Latino vote's concerned, the possibility that a Latino-friendly candidate like Jeb Bush is going to make it looks pretty dim. And he would be very effective, I think. He speaks good Spanish. He'd be on Univision and Telemundo around the clock. And that's just not going to happen, I don't think. On the contrary, you're going to get a pretty ugly spewing forth of immigrant bashing and scapegoating Latinos, unless, of course, they continue to focus on now scapegoating Syrian refugees. And on the Democratic side, conversely, it would seem, with Hillary Clinton being all but a shoo-in, there's rumors that she's going to pick one of the Castro brothers as her running mate. So walk us through those possibilities. I know that it's not an exact science here, but I think those predictions are pretty safe.
Well, the basic premise of the 2016 election is that there's going to be an open seat. And in open seat cycles are always the highest turnout cycle for any electorate in America. So Latinos, you can reliably expect that they'll be, their average over the last six cycles is 80%. So we can reliably expect 80% of registered to turn out. Now, if you have the Trump factor, let's call it, in California, the Trump factor caused a 20% jump in the rate of Latino turnout in 1994 against Pete Wilson. They voted at 83%. Their average is in the 60s. In 1998, they voted at 77%. So it caused a jump. In Arizona, about a 10 to 20% jump in the rate of turnout. So that's a rule of thumb. I mean, we don't have a national test yet. This could be the national test if Trump is candidate. Quantifying the backlash? But that's only one method of quantifying the backlash. Because, Ian, remember, Latinos are only 50% registered. Today, there's 13 million Latino registered voters, slightly under 13 million, according to the Census Bureau study. And there's another 12 million plus that are unregistered. So a contest with Trump on the ticket, conversely, or with one of the Castro brothers on the ticket with Hillary, if we accept your premises, which we can, there's a longer conversation, we accept those premises. Latinos are great at mobilizing against people the villains mobilize Latinos. Let's just say that villains mobilize Latinos. P. Wilson, Joe Arpaio, and we can expect that with Trump. But also, identity politics matters. So when you have Latinos at the top of the ticket, that's also a mobilizing factor.
Well, but what about the possibility of Trump crashing and burning, although it looks like he may go into the convention with more delegates than anybody, but a lot of analysts think that Ted Cruz is going to pick up the pieces if Trump and Carson self-destruct. and there's also Rubio as well. Either of those, do you think? I mean, first of all, Cruz can't even speak Spanish, so I don't know how anybody can see him as a Latino candidate, but he certainly has suggested he has some credentials in that department, whereas Rubio has sort of backed away from being a more compassionate conservative, particularly on immigration, but a lot of people think he might be a real contender too.
Well, the Cruz has enveloped himself. He's covered himself in Donald Trump's campaign blanket, let's so to speak. So, you know, Cruz will not be able to back out of the anti-immigrant crouch that he's in now. He does not, as a Texas elected official, he did not do well with the Mexican-American voters in two statewide elections in Texas. And he doesn't seem to care. He's never campaigned as a Latino and never appealed specifically to the Latino vote. So to me, he will be like Trump light if he gains from a Trump collapse. I would think a bigger, smarter play by Republicans would be some combination of, you know, Rubio, Bush, Kasich. I can't, you know, explain how that would happen, but, you know, it's like the logic. If the Tea Party collapses, Rubio appears to be acceptable to the Tea Party. If Rubio is at the top of the ticket, then you have to think about battleground state logic. And Bush and Kasich give you Ohio, Florida, Texas, or Ohio, Florida are the relevant battleground states. So you have that architecture possible. If somebody else is able to wrest it away from Trump / Carson, that's not anybody that I mentioned, or that's not Rubio, then you have other Republicans to put on the ballot that are Hispanics that are pretty good, like Brian Sandoval, the governor of Nevada from a battleground state, or Susan Martinez, the governor of New Mexico. These are conservatives, but they're not Tea Party conservatives. These are, and Brian Sandoval's a pretty, you know, he's sort of center-right. Well, they're very attractive. They're not big battleground states, but they're battleground states, and they, especially Sandoval, he's from Texas, can be substantially attracted to Latino vote. So, but when it's all said and done, we're really talking about a successful Republican candidate, given the givens, unless it's, you know, frankly, Marco at the top of the ticket, in which he stops being anti-immigrant and starts being pro-immigrant from here forward. If he stays being anti-immigrant, the Democrats will wrap it around his neck, and he won't be able to recover for it. The better one is Jeb Bush. I don't see him getting traction, but it's only November. The successful Republican campaign is looking at 30%, 32%, you know, something like that. I don't see a scenario, given the givens, where Republicans get above 35 or even close to 35 in 2016, because they've taxed so far to the right, the majority of them, right? And the ones that haven't taxed to the right are at 5% in the polls. So they put themselves in a hard place to recover. Is it doable? Tremendous candidate, tremendous campaign, a couple of bad turns in current events. Yeah, but it would take that.
Well, Antonio Gonzalez, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I hope you have a very happy Thanksgiving, and you've given us a lot to think about, and I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Ian. It's always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, who's the president of the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S., the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. And during Gonzalez's tenure, it has nearly tripled Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 14 million registrants in 2012. He is a regular commentator on the Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Session. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the annihilation of nature, human extinction of birds and mammals.
speak out loud of the things you are proud of. And if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Paul Ehrlich, the Bing Professor of Population Studies and the President of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University. He's the founder of MARB, which is the Millennial Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, which connects activists, scientists, humanists, and civil society to foster global change. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Population Bomb, Population Control, or Race to Oblivion. And his latest book is The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Ehrlich.
Nice to be here. Very nice to be here.
And Paul, some of your speeches are here in the Pacifica Radio archives that go back, of course, to 1949. There's a speech of yours, which we'll be playing today, from 1967, an address that you gave at the Stanford Summer Alumni College in August the 3rd of 1967. Okay.
I was 3 years old. That's an interesting.
Right, but you were sounding the alarm back then, and it has gotten demonstrably worse since then, hasn't it? The planet, the biosphere?
Much, much scarier. I mean, what we see going on now in Europe, a combination of the massive flow of refugees, which was predicted. There was a wonderful novel written about that in about 1975 called The Camp of the Saints. And this flow of refugees, of course, is tightly tied into climatic events, which influenced food prices to lead to the Arab Spring and which brought farmers moving into towns and making the political situation worse in Syria. So there's a climate change connection and a population connection to all the mess going on today. You got to always remember that North Africa and the Middle East have to import half their food already. And of course, their populations are growing. Their climate is getting worse. They're losing water. So it's a very scary situation. We're a lot closer to the end than we were in 1967.
Well, you know, you've had your run-ins with the Vatican, and there's been a peculiar kind of pushback against your work, often from the African American community, that suggests that somehow you're calling for genocide. How do you deal with that kind of reflexive ignorance? And you know, you'd think that the evidence would be manifestly clear. What's happening to the planet? You know, you just have to turn on the evening news and look at the weather, but somehow or other,
you do the best you can. For example, I was a co-inventor of the sit-in in Lawrence, Kansas, where we desegregated the restaurants. I've written books and papers on how stupid racism is and so on. But it turns out that when you add African Americans to the planet, it's not as bad as adding white Americans to the planet, but it's still bad. And, you know, the racism and sexism are particularly ridiculous. The racism prevents us from using the full power of the brains in some populations. And the sexism is stopping us from halting the population explosion. There's every sign that if women were given equal rights and equal opportunities in every country and equal salaries, that the fertility rate would go down, and that if you, in addition, supplied every sexually active human being with modern contraception and safe backup abortion, that the population would probably begin the slow decline, which is clearly necessary. So, and the Vatican, after all, the Pope knows better. In other words, we wrote an article, John Hart and I, on the Pope's encyclical, which was called Two Cheers for Pope Francis, because he was on the right track on both economics and the climate, but did not say that you've got to give women rights and you've got to deal with the population problem. But that's probably because he didn't want to be assassinated. He's already spoken out saying the church is too fixated on things like abortion and contraception. So, you know, there's slow movement in the right direction in some places, and that should be supported.
Well, that's why the Pope lives in the hotel and not in the Vatican, because he eats at the cafeteria with everybody else, which lowers the risk of being poisoned.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I've literally heard that from credible sources.
Kidding, really.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Ehrlich, who's the Bing Professor of Population Studies and the President of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University. He's the founder of MARB, which is the Millennial Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, which connects activists, scientists, humanists, and civil society to foster global change, and is the author of The Population Bomb, Population Control, or Race to Oblivion. And his latest book is The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. Now let's turn to your book, which I think is a very important book and something that our listeners should consider as a Christmas gift, because it's a gift that keeps on giving, in the sense that it will help perhaps save the planet via the species. I remember reading during the nuclear war period that I worked on nuclear disarmament, and there was a great quote from Bertrand Russell saying, you know, if human beings are so crazy that they want to blow up the planet and turn the Earth into a dead clod orbiting space, I wouldn't mind so much, because I don't have a lot of truck for human beings, but I do care about the butterflies and the nightingales.
Well, we tried in the book to do two things. One is to tell basically the complete story of how we're going into the sixth mass extinction and what it means to us and what we might do about it. And also to bring it home to people, to give them pictures of the animals we know best, the groups of animals, birds and mammals, and tell their stories so we see what interesting and fascinating other creatures we're just wiping out. And the book, it would make a glorious Christmas present, because it's got some of the best photographs of animals ever taken, and not by me. We paid for them, but we're giving all the royalties to a fund at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab that trains conservation, young conservation biologists. So I have a negative financial interest in the book, and I hope everybody will buy it and encourage their friends to give it as a Christmas present, because it is beautiful. The story is not so beautiful, unfortunately, but it's something everybody ought to understand if they appreciate the beauty of the organisms that are pictured.
And again, it's Killing the Koala and Poisoning the Prairie.
Well, you got that's the other book.
Okay. So, sorry, The Annihilation of
Nature. Killing the Koala is not such a friendly book. But
right. No, well, let's go back to the Christmas present. The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals, and it's a first edition. And then just to put in context, Killing the Koala and Poisoning the Prairie, Australia, America, and the Environment. Is that...
Well, it's written with a young ecologist compared to me, a brilliant guy named Corey Bradshaw. Both of us know the United States and Australia and Canada, actually, very, very well. And there's interesting parallels and interesting differences in how we fought the war on the environment. We wanted to make the subtitle Allies in the War on the Environment, but the publisher thought that was too rough. But if you want to see what two ecologists who have been very busily trying to save our civilization actually think, in words of no censorship whatsoever, Killing the Koala is a nice, inexpensive book. You can find either one just by going to Amazon Advanced Search Books and putting in Ehrlich for one, and then either Koala or Annihilation for the other. It'll take you right there.
And Ehrlich, of course, is Ehrlich.
Oh, thank you.
But when you use that ironic title, what's happened, though, is good news, in the sense that the two worst climate deniers on the planet were booted out of office. Abbott, Prime Minister of Australia.
And Harper.
And Harper in Canada. So,
yeah, all we got to do is get rid of the guy in New Zealand, and we'll have at least countries I love all under more reasonable leadership. So it has been great in Australia that they got rid of Abbott, who was absolutely terrible. But it's a parliamentary system, and that works very differently from our system in the United States. After all, the prime minister before Abbott was a single woman, an avowed atheist who was living with her boyfriend. Imagine that in the United States.
And a boyfriend was a hairdresser.
So.
I'm not casting aspersions. I'm just saying how different it is. But in terms of the koala, for example, domestic animals are also a huge threat to the koala, dogs, and now they're trying to eradicate feral cats in Australia, and that's got the FEMA people all upset.
Yeah, well, the point is that cats, domestic cats, are one of the biggest threats to birds over most of the planet. They kill millions of birds every year in the United States, in Britain, in rest of Europe, and so on. Cats should be kept as house pets, and they should be spayed. And populations of cats have caused lots of extinctions, for instance, on Pacific Islands. They're causing them in Australia now. But the problem was that a lot of people, when they moved to Australia, wanted to have memories of Europe and England, and brought all kinds of other animals, which have wrecked the environment of Australia to a very large degree. And so, you know, the Aborigines had the longest sustainable population on the civilization on the planet. They went through all kinds of weather, climate changes, and so on, and lasted something like 40,000 years with a continuous record of very interesting art and so on. So it only took the Europeans a couple of centuries to totally screw up Australia, which they've done a wonderful job of. I mean, when you talk about wrecking a planet, the Australians are even better at it than the Americans, because their part of the planet was much less productive to begin with. There's an interesting picture in the book of the rail networks of the U.S. and Australia today, and you'll see what a difference the basic situation in the two countries is.
Well, but both countries have the world's biggest carbon footprint per capita, don't they?
Yeah, they keep competing on that. And Australia is particularly sad because they mine still gigantic amounts of coal that they then export to other countries. Australia is struggling to become a third world country by basing its economy on natural resources that they ship out unprocessed. The coal that Australia ships annually would make a pile about 6 feet by 6 feet that extends around the world. In other words, they are a huge factor in destroying the world that their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are going to have to live in. Then the U.S., of course, contributes similarly we maintain, for instance, a military. The estimate is that at least 50% of our costs in the military is aimed at maintaining oil flows to the United States. It's like trying to maintain cyanide flows if you are hungry, because, of course, we can't stand to burn the oil. We're going to destroy ourselves by doing that, but we're still spending a fortune and killing a lot of other people in order to keep the oil flowing.
And, of course, I think the best way to describe Australia is China's quarry, which is an unfortunate fact. But just back to the book that we're recommending here today by Paul Ehrlich, The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals, in its first edition, a very, very important Christmas present, a gift that keeps on giving, because you can spread the word in terms of trying to alert people to the casualties of global warming, which are all of the species that we love and celebrate. And every children's book, kids are brought up looking at these pictures and going to zoos, etc., and even perhaps even seeing these animals in nature. But they are, for want of a better metaphor, the canary in the coal mine in terms of where we are as a species. Now, in terms of the sixth great mass extinctions, we're talking about the sixth one here, at least you're warning us about it. I think four of the last five mass extinctions were caused by climate change, weren't they?
They're caused by we're not sure. The one that we're most sure of, I would say, is the one that wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago, was a collision with an extraterrestrial object. The interesting thing there is people say, well, you know, who cares? It doesn't make any difference. Why should we worry? The dinosaurs didn't mean anything to us. But of course, when that happened, there are two important things. One is there was nothing remotely resembling a human being on the planet. There were just mostly rat-like mammals. And if the dinosaurs hadn't been wiped out, they wouldn't have evolved into us. So if we hadn't had that extinction, you'd probably be talking to a velociraptor right now, because the dinosaurs probably would have gotten smart. The way we know that we're entering a mass extinction is by very carefully looking at past rates of extinction in times between the five previous mass extinction events and the rates today. Taking conservative estimates, it's crystal clear that species extinctions at the present time are somewhere between 10 and maybe 200 times as rapid as the background rate between mass extinction rates. And more important, the rate of extinction of populations, which comes before the species is extinct, is thousands of times higher. And that's obvious from all kinds of data. So there's no question at all that having been the result of the fifth mass extinction, in a sense, we are now the cause of the sixth mass extinction. And since these other animals are the working parts of our life support system, along with plants and microorganisms, what we're doing is sawing off the limb we're sitting on. It's kind of ironic that if it hadn't been for a mass extinction, we wouldn't be around. And now we're causing one, which is likely to see to it that our civilization doesn't last, at least, and could eventually wipe us out too.
So in terms of the other hat that you wear as the founder of MARB, Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, which connects activists, scientists, humanists, and civil society to foster global change, I take it this is in many ways the game plan, the action plan, if you will, to address the very things that you've just talked about.
Yeah, that's the case. If you turn on the TV set and it doesn't persuade you, you can't expect anything sensible from government, then you know something has to come from the bottom up. I mean, you know, there's interesting data now on toxic chemicals we're spreading from all over the planet, that they're actually reducing the IQ of the human population, dumbing down humanity. And there are no really good experiments to prove that, but you can prove it for yourself by, say, listening to a Republican presidential debate. So we're facing this horrible situation. We know we're not going to get leadership from the government on it, so we've got to get leadership from civil society. And that means if your big interest, for instance, is having better housing for the poor, which is a very good thing to be interested in, if your organization is working on that, it still should put something like 10% or more of its time into solving the population and consumption problems that are giving us climate disruption. Because if we let the climate increase by 4 or 5 degrees Celsius, there's not going to be decent housing for anyone. That is, whatever your cause, it's a lost cause if we don't reduce the scale of human activity. So lots of things we can do temporarily to help at the present time, but the basic problems have to be suitably dealt with. We've got to get down to maybe 1 or 2 billion people and much less consumption by the rich if we're going to be able to maintain our civilization on this planet for even a few centuries. And we're facing 4 billion more people. That is more than twice as many people added to the population by the end of this century, if we're lucky and don't have a huge die-off.
So this situation, though, reminds me somewhat of the Cold War that mercifully ended with Reagan and Gorbachev, and even though to some extent it's coming back a little bit, unless some cooler heads prevail, but not the pervasive threat that the world could be annihilated. And the very arguments were made back then that you just made now, which is, look, nothing matters unless we stop the threat that everything on this planet can be destroyed in 30 minutes. And guess what? It did end.
I mean, I hate to give you bad news, though. Right. Everybody I know that looks closely at this thinks the chance of an accidental nuclear war between the United States and Russia is now higher than it was for most of the Cold War. And chances of a small nuclear war, which would destroy our civilization between India and Pakistan, is much, much higher than it's ever been before. Right? It's scary enough that there are many people in both India and Pakistan that would like to have a nuclear war. There's actually many people who think the Mumbai terrorist attacks was an attempt to generate a nuclear war. Get your listeners to go to the web and look up Theodore Postel at MIT, Postol. He's got a wonderful few-minute video explaining why we are in such a dangerous situation with the Russians. You can find all this stuff on the web. It's nothing new, but it's interesting that our media have paid no attention to the greatly increasing threat of nuclear war, which, as effective as the mass extinction event, it would pitch in on that and quite possibly certainly end civilization and maybe put humanity on the road to extinction.
Well, I was about to offer somewhat alternative argument.
Sorry, I didn't mean to depress you totally.
No. But let me just at least offer the argument, which is that the fact that people around the world got together and demonstrated, and the anti-nuclear movement was a powerful and sustaining movement around the world, it did have an effect. And it's true that we've had psychological disarmament, but not physical disarmament. The weapons haven't gone away. But the fact that we don't have that perpetual hostility is actually a step forward.
And I was, I agree.
I was suggesting that the same arguments apply to what you're talking about to avoid the sixth mass extinction is simply the world has to be mobilized. And my sense is that there's a very, very clear and present unifying principle here that we can use, which is that we're all together in lifeboat Earth. So what is required, since we share a common threat, is a kind of global patriotism.
I agree completely. It's clear that the nation-state system, which is only a couple hundred years old, has had it. It doesn't work. We've got to work very hard on new forms of global governance, which basically make everybody a global citizen. The problem is that we have millions of years of evolution, cultural and biological, as a small group animal. We're very used to dealing with groups of 50 to 200 people, even today. But, of course, now, as a small group animal, for the last few decades, we've been trying to deal with groups of not just thousands or millions, but billions of people, and we're not very good at it. We haven't learned fast enough, and again, you don't see that dealt with in our education systems or in our mass media. It's not working. We've got to find a better way to deal with global problems and as existential threats to our civilization. But global citizenship, as you put it, is a very good way to do it.
Well, let's talk about how our listeners and by extension, more and more citizens, and since everybody knows somebody and everybody's related to somebody and we're all going to be getting together for Thanksgiving, the idea that there is an organization called the MOB, the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, that you can join, along with activists, scientists, humanists, and others in civil society to foster global change. How do people sign up?
Well, you go to mahb.stanford.edu. You become a mobster, mahb.stanford.edu. Takes you a couple of minutes, costs absolutely nothing, and then you can pitch in many ways. You can write stuff, you can join the blogs, you can discuss, and so on. Hopefully it will build. If it doesn't build, it'll be just another one of my failures, that's all. But a lot of people are becoming mobsters, and maybe we can get civil society really moving in the right direction. I don't see any other choice, frankly, except just go down the drain.
Right, but you can't take responsibility for what's happened to the planet since you warned about it, back in the 1960s? It's not all
on
your
shoulder. It's not having any effect.
Right, but
you know, it's like yelling fire and then watching your house burn down and your family die. It doesn't give you a particularly good feeling. Anyway, it's wonderful that you're making the effort. There are some elements in the media that are trying to move things in the right direction, but I'm afraid we're a society, as one of my colleagues said, any society that's main interests are mall crawling and sports is unlikely to have a decent education system or even to persist.
Right, but I feel my mission, Paul Ehrlich, is to make up for the damage that another Australian, Rupert Murdoch, is doing to the planet. So.
Oh, God. He's the main, you know, we had, as I christened it a couple of years ago, the Murdoch summer in Australia, where they almost melted away. But more than any other individual, he has been responsible for the lack of attention to global warming. There are many others in it, but of course, By having a straight propaganda network in the false news network and running newspapers like The Australian and so on, he has managed to delay action, probably even more than the Koch brothers and some of the other or any of their pimps. It's really sad.
Well, but what do you think, though? You mentioned earlier about the sort of clown show that passes for the Republican presidential debates. Is there any chance that in self-destructing, which I imagine that they eventually will, and even if they end up with a Ted Cruz at the head of the ticket, his views are so reactionary, along with, of course, Marco Rubio, who's a global warming denier, maybe by default this issue will come back and it will be exposed for the dangerous fallacy that it is.
I hope, certainly hope so, but the sad thing is I don't think the Republicans care that much about the presidency. They now control the Supreme Court with some of the dumbest people on the planet in it. You've got to remember Scalia on the Supreme Court has actually discussed whether or not surface-to-air missiles ought to be protected by the Constitution with everybody having the right to bear those arms. I mean, these people are deeply nuts, and they control most of the state houses, most of the rest of the political system besides the Supreme Court. The main thing that I pray we will get a Democratic president is that they don't add another total nutcrack case to the Supreme Court, because it's extremely dangerous. But anyway, I hope that people will wake up, but it's going to take a lot of political action, both to get them awakened and also after they're awakened to get control of the government back. So I wish I could be very optimistic, but my main advice to you and others is to drink a lot of good wine and keep your internal environment in good shape while you watch what's happening to the external environment.
And do what you can to stop what's happening to them.
Absolutely. Every human being should be putting something like 10% of his or her time into solving some aspects of these hideous problems, whether it's sexism, racism, decay of our environment, threat of nuclear war. There are things everybody can do there, particularly by pressing on politicians. And getting organized with the mob, of course, and buying the book.
And becoming a mobster.
Right.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Paul Ehrlich.
It was my great pleasure. And everybody get in there and do something.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Ehrlich, who's the Bing Professor of Population Studies and the President of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University. He is the founder of MOB, which is the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, which connects activists, scientists, humanists, and civil society to foster global change. He is author of the best-selling book, The Population Bomb, Population Control, or Race to Oblivion. And his latest book is The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Animals, a book that I highly recommend as a Christmas gift. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.